We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
See that glowing fog out there? It's radiation left over from the Big Bang, the explosion that made the universe 13.8 billion years ago. Right now, we're at the very edge of known space and time. So what happened before the Big Bang? Nobody knows. No evidence survives from before that moment. We've got some pretty crazy ideas about where the universe came from, which we'll get to in time. Where are we in the universe? At the very center. In the observed universe, everyone gets to feel special. No matter which galaxy you happen to live in, when you look out to the universe, you'll find yourself at the center of the cosmic horizon. But this is just an illusion. In reality, there is no center, and the cosmic horizon is no more real than the horizon at sea. It's what you get when you have a finite speed of light in a universe that had a beginning in time.
Well, that's a clip from the fourth episode of Cosmos, a Space-Time Odyssey. Sunday night's episode was titled A Sky Full of Ghosts. Now, I love this kind of stuff. I watch it. I read about it all the time. The question I always want to keep foremost in my mind when I'm watching something like Cosmos, a Space-Time Odyssey, or reading a book on modern cosmology, is this good science? Are they telling me what science and scientists have actually observed and cataloged and been able to confirm with other observations? Or are they theorizing? There's nothing wrong with theorizing. Are they storytelling? Storytelling may not be in the purview of good science. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in live on this Tuesday afternoon, the 1st of April. Joining us for our review of Episode 4 of the TV series Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey, Dr. Danny Faulkner. He holds a PhD in astronomy from Indiana University, and he's professor of astronomy for Answers in Genesis. Dr. Faulkner, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd.
Last Sunday night, was Cosmos doing good science?
Well, it was a mixed bag. I think one thing that a lot of people don't really realize is that the Cosmos, both the original series and this one, is supposed to be a personal voyage. I think the original series had that as like a subtitle. And so it's a mixture of science, but would be operational science as well as historical or origin science, but also, as you said in your introduction, a lot of theorizing and also a lot of philosophy. A lot of assumptions talked about, and the mix is well done to the point that most people watching it have no idea what's assumption, what is philosophy, what is historical observable science, and what's observable science in the here and now. It's kind of a seamless whole to most people, but I see a lot of things there that I wouldn't agree with, and I don't think you can really state for a fact. Like, for one of the things that you had in the introduction you played there, this mention of the universe not having a center. We don't know that. It's assumed by most people, but there have been models in the past of the universe, and even today, where the universe does have a center. The original versions of the Big Bang model, for instance, had a center. It's just right now, that particular model is not favored. So to state that with total certainty, most people would miss the fact that that's not a provable thing. It's an assumption.
I mean, one of the things he said there was, you know, from our vantage point, we can see only so far as what he called the cosmic horizon. That is how long, at least according to their time frames, only out so far as light has been able to travel from the beginning of the universe in any given direction. But then he went on to assert that if you observe the universe from any other galaxy, which I don't think Tyson has done, then it's all going to look the same to you.
Yep, that's you caught that, did you? That's the assumption of what we call homogeneity, that the universe looks the same from every location in the universe. And it's an assumption people make. It makes the mathematics work out easier. It seems reasonable. I wouldn't want to necessarily argue that that's not true. I simply would say it's an assumption that you make. It's not an observation. And again, you're quite correct. No one could conceivably even begin to check that to see if it's really true. So it's not a scientific conclusion. It's an assumption.
He asks the rhetorical question, what happened before the Big Bang? And his response is, well, nobody knows. No evidence has survived from that time before then. There are a lot of crazy ideas, said the host of Cosmos, but they don't entertain every crazy idea about what happens before the Big Bang, do they?
No, they don't. They really don't. And, you know, that struck me that question of before the Big Bang just a few years ago was considered a nonsensical question, because the idea was the Big Bang was the beginning of not only matter and energy, but also space and time. I'm often lecturing about this. I would tell my students and others that if you really, you know, put on your Big Bang hat and you really want to look at this, sometimes people ask, well, what was here before the Big Bang? And I'm saying, well, wait a minute. The Big Bang theory is not just an explosion of matter and energy. It's an explosion, if you will, of space and time itself. When you say what was here before the Big Bang, you're saying here, which involves space, and you're saying before, which involves time, neither of which existed. So I often tell people, according to the Big Bang, before here wasn't here then, and then wasn't then either. So this idea of probing before the Big Bang used to be considered, in conventional cosmological circles, a nonsensical question. But now, with these ideas of multiverse and all sorts of other odd things, that question is being asked. So when the first Cosmos was done 34 years ago, Carl Sagan, I don't think, would have asked that question, what was here before the Big Bang. He would not have asked that question, I'm pretty certain.
Well, that brings us back to a subject we often revisit here in the course of our reviews of Cosmos, a Space-Time Odyssey, and that is rescuing devices. Because all these crazy ideas about what came before the Big Bang, do they all amount to rescuing devices for something they're trying to assert about something that happened after the Big Bang, or something we're observing now?
Yeah, definitely that's a rescuing device. The thing is, this universe we live in has some remarkable properties to it which make life possible. People have written whole books on this. If you just change this little constant a little bit, you change the structure of matter, you change the expansion rate, you change the universal structure to the point that life doesn't exist in this universe. And when you look at it that way, the universe seems extremely improbable. And so people say, well, what's the probability of that taking place just by chance? And it seems so remote that it must be the universe's design. It was created. And, of course, that's anathema to someone who doesn't believe in special creation. So they've developed this thing called the multiverse. I first heard about it probably 20 years ago. And when I read a book on that, I thought, that's the silliest thing I ever heard. But wouldn't you know it, a few years later, it became mainstream, and now people are talking about it as if it's a given fact. It's this idea that universes are always popping into existence. Our own universe is birthing new universes. They kind of pinch off from ours and then are gone. We don't disconnect it from our universe. And that's where our universe came from. So you basically have an infinity, an eternity, if you will, of an infinite number of universes popping into existence all the time, always have and always will. And this universe that we think of as being finite in time and only being so old actually is just one of many, many universes. And so we shouldn't be surprised if there's an infinity of universes that we're in one of the ones at least where life is possible. It's a selection effect. If we were in a universe where life was impossible, we wouldn't be here having this conversation. And that sounds absolutely crazy to most people, but that's the direction that cosmology has gone in the last couple of decades.
One of the things that I dealt with on Sunday night on Cosmos, a Space-Time Odyssey, has now become kind of it's no longer considered a crazy idea, although at one time it was. Now it's actually become quite central to the understanding both of space and time, the nature of space, and of kind of the structures of galaxies, and that is black holes. How well did they do on the idea of black holes on Cosmos?
Well, I would say they did a really good job. As it turns out, I like black holes. I think there's a good deal of data to support the idea that they exist. I found a number of fellow creationists, not astronomers, but creationists, who are very suspicious of black holes. Somehow they think that those have been devised to hypothesized to salvage evolutionary ideas, but that's really not the case. He mentioned Cygnus X-1, I believe. It was the first black hole discovered back about 50 years ago now. They didn't know what it was at first. But this idea of binary systems, so you have a star and a black hole orbiting each other, and material from the star being pulled off and falling into the black hole and giving heating up as it does this and giving off X-rays. We call these X-ray binaries, and we know of probably scores of these now. And I happen to study professionally eclipsing binary stars. And so I know something about the accretion phenomenon that we see there. I know something about modeling these things. And I think the science, the operational science, I would say, is quite compelling that black holes of many different varieties actually exist. And so I would give him probably an A on his handling of black holes itself. Now, he got kind of fanciful there at the end, was, you know, asking the question, well, what if you went into a black hole, what would happen? Well, he was using his spaceship of the imagination, and that's fine. But again, I'm fearful that a lot of people watching this wouldn't quite get that. They might think, well, this is good science. My wife, we were sitting there watching it Sunday night, and she asked me about black holes and the destruction of physics, as it were. And I said, yeah, that's what happens. Our physics leads us to this idea that black holes exist. But when you try to cross the event horizon, the boundary of a black hole, suddenly physics doesn't work. We encounter these nasty things called singularities, where mathematically things are undefined. And so our physics breaks down. And so obviously whatever's going on inside of a black hole, it's being governed by some physics that we don't even know about yet. So it tells me our physics theories, as good as they are incomplete.
Now, we should say here before we move on to a different subject that was treated there, on Cosmos, that even the kind of the preeminent thinker in terms of black holes, Stephen Hawking, who's kind of I'm getting a sense, at least by some of the cosmology writers, that they're taking him less seriously than they used to. But his early work is certainly highly respected on black holes. He has really modified what he thinks black holes are all about since he first came up with or started studying them in earnest, hasn't he?
Yeah, he's probably, he didn't start this thing back in the 60s, but he jumped in early, and he's probably written more on black holes than anybody else, almost everybody else put together. And recently, he suggested that he was rethinking black holes completely. And I have not taken the time to try to digest what he's talking about there. I don't know if he's really fully divulged it anyway, but it's at least the reports I heard a few months ago, he was almost suggesting black holes don't exist, which that's a tough one for me to swallow. I'm a little behind on this one, and I'm not sure he's totally right about that one. But, yeah, they are rethinking this.
Dr. Danny Faulkner is our guest. We're reviewing episode 4 of the TV series Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey. He holds a PhD in astronomy from Indiana University, and he's professor of astronomy for Answers in Genesis. We'll be right back.
I'm not a Christian, but I listen to your show because actually you do have some interesting topics.
Here's a recent comment from the Issues Etc. comment line.
You believe that there's not one error in the Bible. That's intellectually infantile. You also believe that Jesus is coming again. You promote extremely sexually repressive views.
The Issues Etc. comment line. Available 24/7. 618-223-8382.
Have fun waiting for Jesus to return. Got news for you. He ain't coming back.
Check out the updated showroom at Valo Floor Coverings, 1009 Plummer Drive in Edwardsville. Valo's offers free in-home measurement, interior design consultation, and experienced installation. Celebrating 50 years of trusted experience, Valo Floor Coverings, 1009 Plummer Drive in Edwardsville, 618-656-7788 or valofloor.com.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
That first presentation will be on how lawyers look at making the case for the reliability of the New Testament.
Craig Parton talking about his presentation at this summer's Issues Etc. Making the Case conference.
the information we have about Jesus, primarily about his life and death and resurrection, primarily comes from the four Gospels, certainly from the rest of the New Testament. But if the record we have of Jesus Christ can't be relied on, we're doomed.
You can meet and hear Craig Parton making the case for the historical Jesus June 13th and 14th at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Collinsville, Illinois. For more information, just look for the Making the Case logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, or call 618-223-8385, 618-223-8385. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 13th and 14th in Collinsville, Illinois. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Danny Faulkner is our guest. We're reviewing episode 4 of the TV series Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey. Let's turn to one of the subjects that I think they probably treated pretty well. Tell me what you think about it, Dr. Faulkner, in the fourth episode of Cosmos, and that is the nature of light, the speed of light, and what it has to do with how we observe the universe and a lot of the conclusions that are drawn about the universe in which we live. How would you describe it?
Okay, well, Tyson commented on the fact that when we look at anything, be it a distant galaxy or star or even something across the room, we're sort of looking at it in the past. I mean, it presumably takes a finite length of time for light to reach us from across the room, across the galaxy or whatever. And so we're kind of seeing back into time as this whole point. And he likened it to a time machine. I think it's a little overwrought. A lot of people are talking it that way now. And also about these ghosts, maybe some of these stars we're looking at may have died out long ago. I guess you could maybe make a comparison to sound. If you see something off in the distance, say a loud noise, maybe someone hitting a baseball or something, you see the ball being hit, but then it's a delay when you hear the crack of the bat, because it does take finite length of time for sound to travel. And I think his point was that the universe must be very old, because the universe is very big, and we can measure distances to galaxies and quasars and such, and many of those are millions or even billions of light years away from us. And so if light has been traveling at the same rate ever since it left those objects, then it must have taken millions or billions of years to get here. Now, he then took direct aim at biblical creationists. I thought that was interesting. He said, you know, some people think that the universe is only 6,000 or 7,000 years old, but, you know, if so, how can we see all these distant objects? And I chuckled to myself. I thought, well, why did he pick that figure? Why did he pick 6,000 or 7,000 years as opposed to any other figure? And the only reason I can figure is because he was thinking about people like me who believe in biblical creation and come to realize the Bible must indicate that the world is only about 6,000 years old. And I thought that was interesting. Without mentioning us, he certainly was taking aim at that point at us. And we're well aware of this problem. I think I saw one website already is just applauding what Tyson said as a slam dunk end of debate for recent creation. But he's kind of late coming to this, because this problem has been around a long time. We call it the light travel time problem. And I'm aware of at least 6 different possible solutions that recent creationists have provided. This is a problem for us. I mean, I do believe the world is only thousands of years old, not millions of years old, so how can we see these things? And we've all attempted to explain this in various means. So we, even though it's a problem for us, we do have explanations out there.
Really, I mean, to kind of just outline the nature of the problem from the cosmologist's perspective, if in fact, according to their perspective, if in fact the universe is only 6,000 years old, we should be able to see to its edge really well.
And then nothing beyond that. Yeah.
And nothing beyond that. Or we should only be able to see just about the better part of all our galaxy, but nothing beyond it.
And that's what he was laying out. And again, we need explanation for that. You can argue that the universe really isn't that big, and some people have argued that. I don't agree with that. You could argue the speed of light has changed over time. You can argue a number of different things. And are we invoking a rescuing device? Well, yeah, we are. I have no problem with that. You got to realize, however, that people who believe in the Big Bang also have a light travel time problem. They have this thing called the horizon problem in the cosmic microwave background, which you talked about in an earlier episode. And the problem is there that you don't have time in their Big Bang model to get light traveling around the universe to come to the same temperature. And they invented this thing called inflation over 30 years ago to solve this problem. It was it's a rescuing device as well. So everybody has a light travel time problem, it would seem, and everyone then is allowed a rescuing device, it would seem. It just seems kind of unfair to me that that you would say, well, you folks can't invoke a rescuing device, but you better let us invoke ours.
Well, and that's not even to mention, I mean, to kind of expand the subject a little bit to biological evolution, what is often not acknowledged is that they don't have enough time in the universe for all the things who have happened, especially since when they think the solar system came into existence. They don't have enough time to have gotten to where we are today.
I think so, yeah.
All right. One of the things, coming back to the black holes, one of the things that he talks about there, and you said he did a fairly accurate depiction of the black holes. One of the things that he talked about there is the nature of time and how, you said before, physics breaks down, but isn't it also that we're talking about kind of space and time breaking down in proximity to a black hole, and that's why the physics doesn't work?
Oh, well, that's the way we generally say it, is the space and time break down, but I would rather think that it's our understanding of space and time. Okay, I mean, to say that space and time break down is supposing that our general relativity, our best understanding of space, time, and gravity, is the correct and complete description of matter, space, time, and energy. And what I'm saying is, I don't think it is. I think the fact that the mathematics breaks down should tell us that there's a problem with our model, rather than there being a problem with the universe. You know, a poor craftsman blames his tools. He never blames himself for doing a poor job. And so here we're blaming the universe rather than blaming our tools that we've developed, is my point.
How did Cosmos, in its fourth episode, do in kind of its little historical segment that it likes to do? It does scientific history. How did it do?
Well, I don't know. I had a little thing with William Herschel walking his young son John on the beach and having these conversations, and I don't know enough about the history of the interaction between John and William to say that really happened or not. I mean, when I kept watching this, I kept thinking, well, maybe this happened, but I've never heard of this before. It seemed almost too convenient. And in the past, the series has played a little loose and free with history. I know with Bruno in the first episode, they completely blew the history of that one. So I'm just a little suspicious now. You know, I know that they have a track record now of not dealing with the history. So I'm just a little cautious in history, questionable about the history that they had there with the interrelationship and the discussion going on. He talked about William Herschel, you know, knowing that the universe was very big, millions of light years and so forth. He didn't know that. The first measurement of stellar distance was in 1830s, and William Herschel was already dead by then. He did attempt to estimate distances to stars by measuring their brightnesses, and he assumed that they all had about the same brightness, which is a really crude estimate because there's a huge range in the brightnesses of stars. When you do that, though, for a large number of stars, you can get kind of a statistically meaningful average out of this. And what he was trying to show was that the stars are, you know, scores of light years away many times. But that's not, you know, millions of years. That came actually much later. And I think they were leaning on the history there quite a bit and kind of giving credit to Herschel things that were really found much at later.
Now, you mentioned that current cosmology also makes certain assumptions about the brightness. In fact, they do, whether it's a certain class of supernova or a certain class of stars that they think they can observe in distant galaxies, things like that, they do lean heavily, even now, upon assumptions about how bright stars ought to be and, in fact, are out there so far away.
Yeah, I would say in defense of that, though, that there is a a certain amount of what I think is reasonably good observational data to support belief in that, and also some good understanding of physics that would support it. Having said that, I think there's also some problems. For instance, even getting the distances to nearby galaxies, such as the Andromeda Galaxy, there's been some discrepancy of how far they really are. Some people I know in the field of eclipsing binary stars have studied some systems in some nearby galaxies and gotten a distance to it, to those galaxies, and it's at variance with what they find by some of those stars you're talking about there. It's not a huge variance, but it's a bigger variance than anybody would have thought. So there is some uncertainty there, and it's a mix of pretty good operational science, well-understood physics, but also some discrepancies that nobody can explain at this point.
A question from Miles in St. Louis. He says, I speculate that the golden age of science coincided with the expansion of Christendom and is now past. Science can't properly exist apart from philosophy, and current beliefs are completely adrift. I think that we are now in a post-science age of technology and applied science. So few creationists seem to be at work in actual science. What are your thoughts there on his observation?
Oh, I couldn't agree with that more. Science arose in the 17th century under the influence of some very godly men who took Scripture and the Bible and God very seriously, and they had a holy calling about this. They were thinking God's thoughts after him, and it got hijacked in the so-called Enlightenment, and I'm very pessimistic about the future of science. It's not just technology, but also model building, very model dependent results. A lot of simulations are done, a lot of probabilistic arguments, and the way science is done now is done very differently than it was even just a few years ago. So I think we're entering a post-science age.
Finally, then, anything else stick out to you, strike you as odd in the fourth episode of Cosmos, a Space-Time Odyssey?
No, not really. I guess I was expecting, I don't know what I was expecting, but it tries to encompass a lot of different things, and again, a lot of conjecture there, and a lot of personal opinions. He was talking about inside of a black hole, a universe coming into existence, popping into existence via black holes. We could be birthing universes inside of black holes, and that... That's pretty fanciful. I mean, that's philosophical and high sci-fi stuff. That is not science, not a whit of science in that part that he was talking about.
For the intended audience, do you think that now four episodes in, Cosmos, a Space-Time Odyssey, is doing a basically good or poor job in terms of just educating on the subjects it's treating?
Oh, boy, that's a loaded question because you're asking on the subject it's treating. If its point is to introduce philosophical ideas that go far beyond science, then it's doing a very good job. But if it's just a science show, I can't give it high marks. It really is introducing a lot of philosophical assumptions and metaphysical assumptions masquerading as science. And that does concern me because I see the difference, and many people I know see the difference, but unfortunately many people watching it I don't think do.
Dr. Danny Faulkner holds a Ph.D. in astronomy from Indiana University, and he's professor of astronomy for Answers in Genesis. We will post a link to Answers in Genesis under the Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org. Dr. Faulkner, thank you very much, and I'll talk with you next week.
You're welcome. See you then.
Up next, we're going to have Pastor Jonathan Fisk of Worldview Everlasting respond to actress Emma Watson's recent comments while being interviewed for her press junket on the Noah movie that she is, as many believe they are, spiritual, but not religious. Jonathan Fisk of Worldview Everlasting, right after this.
There are nearly 20 million college students in the United States. 40% will stop going to church during college. 50% will never return. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is seeking to meet this challenge through LCMSU. Why? Because 100% of college students matter to God and to His church. College is tough. You need Jesus. We'll help. LCMSU. Check us out at lcms.org/lcmsu.
Does your church need a full-time or backup organist? The Virtual Organist Service from Church Music Solutions is genuine organ leadership, using your instrument with your specific selections when you need it. You can try it out for free with our demo unit, which allows you and your members to hear and see the virtual organist without obligation and without a sales pitch. For more details, go to churchmusicsolutions.com.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Resurrection Lutheran, Detroit, Michigan. Bethlehem Lutheran, Parma, Ohio. St. Paul's Lutheran, Lockport, Illinois. Faith Lutheran, Columbus, Indiana. Glory of Christ Lutheran, Plymouth, Minnesota. Good Shepherd Lutheran, Arnold, Missouri. Peace Lutheran, Sussex, Wisconsin. Our Redeemer Lutheran, Cedar Falls, Iowa. Zion Lutheran, Moberly, Missouri. And Elm Grove Lutheran, Elm Grove, Wisconsin. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, and click support. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll advertise your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support. The Issues Etc. 300.
Smartest listeners in radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Do you wish your Lutheran school offered Latin, Greek, or logic? What about German or calculus? Right now, local Lutheran schools in two different states are utilizing Wittenberg Academy to expand their course offerings. Whether it's Latin for third graders or logic for seniors in high school, Wittenberg Academy can help. For your homeschooler or for your brick-and-mortar Lutheran school, we have solutions. To find out more, visit wittenbergacademy.org.
Martin Luther taught that the chief function of music and worship was the proclamation of the Word of God. With Heirs of the Reformation, Treasures of the Singing Church, you will hear over two centuries of Lutheran musical theology, beautifully performed and faithfully sung. For a limited time, save 10% on this 4-CD set when you use promotional code URA. Simply visit cph.org today. Lutheran thought, Lutheran substance, Lutheran music. Brought to you by Concordia Publishing House.